temnozelena. O mraku na zemlji in tistih, ki mi žijo. Osvobajamo naravo v senci. Osvobajamo okolje senc. Najsvetlejša oddaja o za naravo najtemnejših časih. Najbolj aktivistična med 16.777.216 barvami. Oddaja, ki ne farba. Ko se med 490 in 570 nanometri stemni na 89,3.
Dobrodošli v sedmi ediciji Temnozelene, brezskrupulozno naravocentrične radijske oddaje. Z vami sem Katarina. Če tudi smo v minuli ediciji Temnozelene menili, da bo do danes jasno, ali se nahajamo pred pričetkom zbiranja podpore za še en referendum v tej državi, gre pa za sago z imenom TEŠ 6, se v tem času ni zgodilo nič bistveno novega. Ne preostane nam kaj drugega, kot da v prijetnem hladu počakamo na nadaljevanje in medtem še v tretje prisluhnemo predavanju Derika Jensna na Pacific Northwest College of Art. Tokrat so na vrsti vprašanja in odgovori, po besedah poznavalcev teritorij, kjer Derek Jensen najbolj zablesti.
Okay, we have a microphone. So questions, and I would like to put forward a rule on questions. Which is, if you're going to ask a question, you get a maximum of 3 sentences, the last one of which has to end with a question mark. No semicolons.
Hi. So this just came to me, and I don't really know where it's going, but I just want you to have a respond. Like, how would you define, I mean, how would you distinguish between an artist and an artisan? That is fine art and its role versus sort of practiced land-based skills like the farming, the making, the doing, crafts. And how, you know, for you in terms of, yeah, so that's just it. There's the question, just art, for the fine artist versus the artisan. And I don't know where I'm going, I just thought I'd throw it at you.
Well, I was hoping you would know where you're going, because I have no idea where to go with that.
You don't?
No, right, I don't. Well, we can see, it's a hugely important question. Well, I don't know if it's an important question. It's an interesting question, and the only reason I'm hesitating whether it's important, I'm not trying to insult you at all, is it's important if I can get past the surface where it's like labels. My first response is like, I don't care if it's, you know, I don't care about art versus artisan, because what's important is whether I can eat the food or whether I can... how the book affects me, but there's...
Well, maybe the world of theory versus the practical. You know, and where where we're at in
Great.
The society in terms of skills that
yep.
we've trans...
Yeah,
we've
yeah,
given
yeah.
away.
Yeah, I'm totally with you now. Thank you. I still don't have an answer. And I think that what is important to me is physical reality. If I have a religion, it is physical reality, and that, which doesn't mean that there isn't something else, but that physical reality is what's real. And if we don't eat, we die. And I think the role of a theorist, and I guess I would include a fine artist as a theorist in this sense, okay? The role of a propagandist, using this in a value-neutral sense, is to help influence behavior. And what I know is that there have been books that have changed my behavior, and there have been paintings that have changed my behavior. But now the hesitation I'm running into is there have also been items of use that have changed my behavior that would not be classified as strictly artistic. You know, part of my concern, I understand the thing about theory, and there's something I want to get at with that, but it's like, So, you know, my mom put this on here, and is this artisanship or is this art, you know? I don't, and she did this from a design. This is not art? No, I don't know. I don't know. See, that's the thing, is I don't know. And it's the same with somebody who is changing the theory of beekeeping. That would affect people's behavior as well. And part of the difficulty I'm having, it is a hugely important question, and part of the difficulty I'm having is that one of our problems in this culture, I've got a couple books coming out soon. One of them is written by Eric McBay and Lear Keith and I, and it's called Deep Green Resistance. It's basically about forming militant organizations it's how do we stop this culture from killing the planet? And I've got another book coming out, which is called Dreams, which is about where do our dreams come from? Where does the muse come from? And I have no idea why I'm telling you all that. And one of the things I say in the Dreams book is that I think one of our problems is that we don't perceive the world. I think we would perceive the world more accurately. I said this in Language of the Words too, but I talk about a lot more in this book. I think we would perceive the world a lot more accurately if we perceived the world the way we perceive our dreams. And what I mean by that is if I have a dream in which there's a horse, it's like the next day I wake up and it's like, oh, there's a horse in my dream, and what's a horse mean? And then I think about, you know, a brown horse means this, and it was jumping, and that means that. And if in waking reality I see a horse, it's like, wow, I saw another fucking horse. But there's to live in a world, we already live in a world that's filled with meaning, and to recognize that meaning I think would make our lives much richer and make us much more sane people. And what does it have to do with your comment, or what it has to do with it, is that I don't really understand why why baking bread or making a shoe couldn't be an artistic endeavor as well. The thing that's falling apart for me is I'm having a trouble distinguishing between what is and isn't art. That's where I'm falling apart. And I don't know what to do with that lack of understanding how to make that boundary, if that makes any sense whatsoever. So let's try another question that I can then actually not answer.
I'm sort of wondering, you talk a lot about rape, and I just want to know how, sort of based on the other ideals you talk about, how you kind of justify fighting violence with such violence.
Well, I think first, it is unfortunate that this culture really has one word to talk about violence. Because I think that it doesn't work for me, at least, to use the same word to talk about a man raping a woman as to use the same word for her kicking him in the testicles. And to use the same word to describe a mountain lion killing a deer, and to use the same word to describe cutting down a forest and putting in a parking lot. Oh, sorry, that's called development. I think it's really problematical to use the same word for all of those. Because I don't think it's the same thing at all. And since I don't think it's the same thing, I don't run into that concern. It doesn't, I mean, I guess my short answer, my long answer is endgame. My short answer is I don't have a problem with using counterviolence to stop violence. And I don't have a problem with self-defense. I don't have a problem with defending those one loves. You know, if someone were going to kill my mom, And the most likely chance of success were for me to kill the person attempting to kill my mom, I would do it. And well, A, I don't have a, well, the question was, isn't that succumbing to a hierarchy? A, I don't have a problem with hierarchy. When I used to go hunting, and this is, the only thing I ever got was lost, so. I was a terrible hunter, well, great hunter from the deer perspective. And when we were in the truck, we were all equals. And when we got out of the truck, I would listen to everything they said because they were really good hunters, and I was terrible. And so I have no problem with hierarchy in that sense. If I am bleeding internally from Crohn's disease, and there are 15 people in the room who can attempt to do something about this, and one of them happens to be a gastroenterologist, I would probably rather that person were at the top of the list for people who are doing something to help me. So I don't have a problem with hierarchy in that sense. And second, I don't see how stopping someone from killing my mom is a hierarchy anyway. And in fact, with a woman or a man stopping a rapist from raping a woman, that's actually destroying the patriarchal hierarchy in that sense, because the hierarchy says it's acceptable for the man to rape the woman. I think shooting him in the head stops the cycle right there.
I get your rationale, but that person has loved ones, so how do you stop the cycle of violence?
I think you stop the cycle of violence through 500 years of sustainable cultures. You can't stop it in the short term. There's a book by Peggy Reeves Sanday. I don't remember the name of it right now, but in this book she talks about why some indigenous cultures are high rape and some are low rape. And most of the markers for high rape cultures are what you'd expect. They valorize men, devalue women. Highly militarized cultures are usually high rape cultures. Male sky god, who's a creator being a male sky god is an indicator of a high rape culture usually. It's a really weird fucking idea to have a male god creator. But anyway, the cultures with a female, with a goddess creator, or a pair creator, are usually lower rape, and just stuff you really expect. But there was one that really surprised me, which is, if there's a history of ecological dislocation in the last 400 to 500 years, that's often an indicator of a high rape culture. Okay, that's Peggy Reeves Sanday. Now I'm gonna extrapolate, so don't blame her for what I'm saying next. But what that says to me is that when a culture gets stressed, one of the ways that manifests is through men doing violence to women, by male pattern violence against women. I'm not excusing it. I'm saying that can be an indicator. And another thing that says to me is it takes 400 to 500 years for a culture to die down, for a culture to settle down from that extreme stress. And right now we're in an extremely traumatic culture, you know. And all of my books are about how, you know, whether from public schooling or industrial schooling, I should say, industrial schooling to industrial jobs to, you know, to mass media. I mean, it's all just horrifically traumatic. To child-rearing practices, all these things. And that's going to take a long, long time to settle down for that. And one of the ways it settles down is through these new stories. And I would suggest, and if you disagree, that's great. You know, you can, and I would certainly encourage you to write your own stories, because what we need is we need all these different voices. This is probably the only place I really believe in, sort of the marketplace, is in the marketplace of ideas, with different people throwing out different ideas, and we see which ones stick, you know? And so the point is that one of the things I think needs to happen is we need to change stories such that there is no longer, that those higher on the hierarchy can no longer do violence against those lower on the hierarchy with impunity. So that's a story that needs to change. And, oh, here's the thing also. People have said to me, so, you know, I don't know if you've read my books, but I write in some of my books about how my father was very abusive. And people have said to me, well, do you forgive your father? I was like, well, I don't really like the word forgive because it makes me think of the Pope or something. But, you know, it's like, if I'm going to use that word, then like, no, I can't because his behavior is still abusive. And do I forgive rapists? Do I forgive abusers of any sort? It's like, no, not until they're no longer perpetrating. Once they're no longer perpetrating and they have done everything they can to make amends, then we can talk about it. But in the meantime, all I need to do is stop them. And Luis Rodriguez talks about this. He's a former gang member who got out through the Literature Revolution, wrote a really good book called La Vida Loca, Gang Days in LA. And I interviewed him years ago, and one of the things that he said is when he was younger, he wanted to kill every cop he saw, and because cops had killed a lot of his friends. And what he realized is he didn't want to kill the cops themselves, because when they took off their uniforms, they're just men, most cases, you know, sometimes women, but they're just people. But what he wanted to do was to kill the social relationship that allowed the cops to kill his friends. He wanted to kill their identity as a cop. And a great example of this is my sister. Somebody broke in on her, God, in the 1970s, somebody broke in on her to rape her. And she had always been told to keep a bottle of antibiotics by her bed. And how strange is it that we live in a culture where mothers have to tell their daughters what to do if someone breaks in on them to rape them? That's horrific just to think about that. So anyway, always keep a antibiotic pill by her bed. And she told the guy, she was reading one morning after her husband left for work, and she was lying on her stomach, and he all of a sudden there was a knife at her throat. And she said, well, you can rape me if you want, but I got VD and my husband and I are being treated for it right now, and you can look at the bottle of antibiotics. And thank goodness he didn't, because the antibiotic's like 4 years old or something. And he said, okay, in that case, give me your money. And my sister, oh, she had $20 in her wallet, and she gave him 10. That is so my sister. Anyway, the point is that what my sister did is she broke his identity. She killed him as a rapist in that moment. She broke his identity as a rapist and caused him to become a thief, a robber. Do you see what I'm saying? He no longer identified as a rapist in that moment because of her stratagem. I'm not saying that every woman should try this. I'm just saying, you know, I mean, if she'd have had a gun, she could have killed him. Fine, I don't care. But the point is, she broke his identity. And one of the things we need to do, that's the point I'm getting at with breaking the cycle, is one of the things we need to do is to break people's identities as perpetrators of the abuse. And there we go, back to the original question. I would say there's a big difference between violence and abuse in my perspective. It's a huge difference. Anyway, so what we need to do to break the cycle, one thing we need to do is break their identity. And that can in some cases involve killing them. You know, it's like, how are you going to stop Ted Bundy? You know, either you're going to kill him or you're going to put him in prison. And putting him in prison involves force too, you know, because nobody walks in on their own. So some people, Ted Bundy is just a real easy example, need to be stopped. And he was somebody's kid too. I'm sorry. I don't mean that sarcastically. I mean, I've read a couple years ago, I got kind of upset. I mean, if I'm going to talk about violence, one of the things I've done is I've done a lot of research into like death penalty stuff. You know, there are some families I feel deeply, deeply sorry for. The families of the perpetrators. As, you know, obviously feel sorry for the families of the victims, but feel sorry for the families of perpetrators. But that doesn't alter the fact that the person did some horrific things. Same is true for CEOs. You know, one of my jokes I used to tell is, what do you get when you cross two, you know, long drug habit, a quick temper, and a gun? And the answer is 2 life terms for murder, earliest release date 2026. What do you get when you cross 2 nation states, a large corporation, 40 tons of poison, 8,000 dead human beings? The answer is retirement with full pan benefits. And that's Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, Bhopal. Actually, this is off subject, but I don't have a problem with the death penalty. I think it should be applied much more broadly to CEOs everywhere. I want to tell you this, too. I had this, and I know we got other questions, but I've been saying for years, I got to tell you this little story. I've been saying for years that there is no legislative solution to the problems we face. I actually have a legislative solution, and all the anarchist people, I was kicked out of the anarchist club a long time ago, but now I'm even further, because there's a legislative solution. Legislative solution is, it involves technology too. It involves remote controlled cigar cutters. Okay, and here's the idea, which is that, I think some people are anticipating where this is going. that anybody like Tony Hayward, I thought of this because of BP, that, okay, so if anybody puts in an oil well and they say it's not going to leak, or they put in a dam and say it's not going to kill salmon, they put in some sort of chemical factory and they say it's not going to cause more poison among the poor people, what this means is they have to, as soon as when they start the thing, and all this is true for everybody from the CEO down to the roughnecks on the oil rig, to the government workers who approve the plans, all this, all the males, I don't know what to do about the females yet, all the males have to put remote-controlled cigar cutters over their genitals. And so Tony Hayward, it's like, great, you want to put in an oil well? Wonderful. If it leaks, say 100 barrels. You know, anything up to 99 barrels, we'll give you. 100 barrels, bzz, it would stop it right away. So I actually want to put up a website one of these days. It just makes me laugh. I want to put up a website one of these days called, I don't have this yet, so don't steal the domain name from me, www.cigarcuttersforpeaceandjustice.com. And I'll put a petition on there, because petitions are the answer to everything. I'll put an online petition saying, yes, we agree that all these people should have cigar cutters put on their genitals. And, you know, sometimes accidentally one might go off or something, but, you know, that's just collateral damage.
How do we find each other if you feel like everyone around you is in denial and your tribe is totally in denial? How do you find each other, find a new tribe that, you know, you don't feel like you're the Lone Ranger and you're insane because you think outside the box?
Well, I think that's another, I mean, all the questions so far have been great, and that's another really important and great question, because we can't do this alone. We need communities. And this is going to sound like I'm being a smart aleck, and I'm not being a smart aleck, which is find new friends. When I was in my 20s, I thought that if I talked about the things that were important to me, that I would lose all my friends. And I spent a lot of time pretty miserable. And then finally, I couldn't help it, and I started talking about the things that were important to me, and I did lose all my friends. And then I found new friends. Does anybody want to be his friend? See? You know, the Spanish anarchists, one of the ways that they were able to gain force is by having salons, by having getting people together in the coffee shops and in the diners and talking. And we need to have these happen in our communities. You know, I'm not part of this community. I'm doing a drive-by. You know, I'm here tonight and I'm gone tomorrow. And so, yeah, you need to find people in your local community. And how do you do that? Well, A, you're asking the wrong person, because I'm a writer, and writers are pretty much by definition, I'll be kind and say introverted. And so I don't know shit about, you know, I gotta tell you, somebody else came up to me before the talk tonight and asked me basically the same question. Actually, here's a moment of truth. You don't have to tell the truth, though. How many people in the audience would be looking for a community? This doesn't mean you're not going to commit, don't worry. You know, all the Sagittarians in the audience, don't worry, you're not committing to anything. I say that as a Sag. So how many of you would like to find a community of people that you would like? Here's the deal. It's like, it's so great to have my friends. I can just call up and say, hey, the stock market went down 300 points today. Fucking score, you know? And how many of you would like to have a community like that and would look for one? Holy shit. Well, those in the front, it's like three-quarters of the audience. I don't know how you find, I mean, hey, there we go, www.matchmakersforpeaceandjustice.com. I don't know how you find each other. I just know it's vitally important. I remember also, years ago, I asked my friend Jeanette Armstrong, Okanagan Indian, writer and activist, I said, what do you do for a social life? And she said, I make long-distance phone calls. You know, all of her local friends, they wanted to talk about football. And I got to tell you one more thing about this, too, which is so many people have asked me, this is odd because this question has come up so often, Derek, how do you deal with Thanksgiving? And honestly, at this point, I talk about football. You know, I can't tell you how many Thanksgiving gatherings I have destroyed. You know, that's like, can anybody except Derek please give the blessing? You know, it's like, I would like to thank the turkey, I would like to thank the potatoes, I would like to thank the soil who gave rise to the turkey, who gave rise to the potatoes. I would like to thank the indigenous people whose land was stolen, on whose land we're now living. And I would like to thank an almighty God for basically killing and smiting everybody who gets in his way. It's like, next time, somebody else. Yeah, so it's like, you know, with, I love my sisters, and, you know, we talk about baseball. But then they're family, you know, it's like friends. It's like, if we don't talk about anything important, then away with you. I don't know. It's.
Maybe send out
one more thing real quick. Maybe send out feelers, you know, like say, you know, you can say something subtle like, hey, I think industrial civilization is killing the planet. And if they respond well, then you take another step. I actually have a project that never did work. I made all these questions that were like 200 questions. It's called Questions for the Endgame, and it's turning into this other project that's going to be a combination of that and a tarot deck. It's kind of weird. But anyway, at first it was just questions, and, you know, like, questions like, what, you know, are there any circumstances in which you would kill a human being? What's your favorite non-human animal? How many non-human animals do you have a relationship with? You know, all sorts of questions like that. And I was just imagining, people could take these for speed dating. I mean, can you imagine like that first one, you know, are there any circumstances in which you kill a human being? Yes? somebody else started this.
Me. So, this is back to like the violence word. And so in talking about like, well, me as like an 18-year-old girl who's been exposed to a lot of images that have probably made me feel very angry, like, and like these are my own issues, but in just going back to just like being human beings, do you feel that we are gonna lash out in anger or violence no matter what the circumstances because of the way that we are made?
I'm sorry, I missed everything after because.
Because of the way that we are made as human beings. Like the biological, like the way that we think, the way that we get sort of angry when like we don't get our way. You know what I mean?
That question, you know what I mean, is kind of like, so when did you stop beating your wife? It's like if I say yes, I know what you mean. It's like, oh shit, he lashes out in anger.
Well, but...
I don't think that, yes, I think we all become angry. I don't think that the fact that we become angry means that we have to hit someone. And I think that getting out anger is one reason that sports exist. Because I really think that, you know, people talk about football being so violent, but I really think that football is really sort of a ritualized form of warfare, and it's really good to get like all the testosterone out. And I think that violence is, I think that sports are a good way to get that sort of aggression, those feelings, out in a responsible manner. The other, on two levels. One is, all I can say is for myself, that if I'm in a relationship and the person lashes out at me in anger, if they lash out, I end the relationship immediately. People can disagree with me and I can disagree with them, but if someone is intentionally hurtful to me, I have a one strike you're out policy. And I also don't do that. And I'm not saying that, you know, nobody ever hurts anybody. I mean, obviously we all say stupid things sometimes, but if somebody is mean to me, that's it. And as a friendship too. And so I don't think, I know that it's not inherent in human beings because I'm a human being and I don't I don't lash out in anger. And then on the social level, I think it's really important that we separate attempts to stop this culture from killing the planet from acting out in anger. I mean, I am full of rage, and I have no problem with rage. I think rage is a fine and righteous emotion. And I don't, this is why in many indigenous cultures, the youth are the warriors and the elders are the ones who make the decisions to go to war. Because the youth have this vigor, and they also think that they're immortal, and they will do a lot of, they have a lot of righteous fury, which is a great and wonderful thing. Something that a lot of young people don't have a lot of, oftentimes, is wisdom and foresight. If I were judged by how I acted when I were 18, well, I'm actually kind of happy that I survived being 18. Because I did a lot of things that were not particularly rational or reasonable, and that were really dangerous and stupid. An example that comes to mind immediately is exploring caves by myself. Anybody who is over like the age of 20 would recognize that there is a serious flaw in this plan. Or I was a little bit younger when I did this, jumping off a second story building. I don't really know why. I certainly didn't think I could fly. I saw him do it on TV, and I thought the ground was a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. The point is that there are gifts that we all bring to a resistance movement, and one of the gifts that the youth bring is energy and a very, very righteous and realistic fury. And just like we need a balance with everything, that fury needs to be balanced, tempered. Tempered is the right word. It needs to be tempered with experience. But I probably have wandered way the hell away from where you were asking. How are we doing? I'm fine going as long as you want, but okay, one more question, and I will not choose who it is. Oh, what
hey
a disappointment.
Hi. So this is a kind of a statement and a question in response to your comment about the connection between science and Christianity. So the statement is that we as humans have this tendency to anthropomorphize, whether we realize that we're doing it or not. And my question is, how do you respond to the idea that we act to stop the destruction of the planet out of a sense of guilt?
Are you, can you restate the question? Because I there's a couple ways I can interpret it, and I'm not sure which it is.
My question is, how do you respond to the idea that we act to stop the destruction of the planet out of a sense of guilt?
No, I heard you. It's just there's a couple ways I can interpret
oh,
it. So can you restate it to
well,
so I can clarify which it is?
Well, I'd like you to respond specifically in relation to your comment about the connection between what you just mentioned about forgiveness and Christianity and science, and the idea that science and Christianity form our knowledge base in this society.
Okay, I'm gonna come back to you in a minute because I don't understand the relationship between the question and Christianity. So I'm gonna go for guilt first. Okay, first off, I don't actually care why people stop the murder of the planet. They can do it out of guilt, they can do it out of joy, they can do it because somebody pays them. I just, I don't care. It's like just so long. I mean, I am so not a purist on that level. What I care about is more wild salmon. I don't really care how. I want the murder to stop. And if people do it because they feel guilty, whatever. That said, I see a difference between guilt and responsibility. And in my perception, at least, guilt has to do with, like, I feel guilty is oftentimes a precursor to inaction. I feel it's a precursor in that it describes an emotional state where I feel like I've internalized what's happened, and I want to contrast that with responsibility, where if I do something harmful, taking responsibility, responsibility comes from the root respondere, which means to give in response. And so responsibility means I'm taking responsibility for what has happened, and I'm going to, or actually even better, because I'm not responsible for warehouse or deforesting, but I can be responsible to the forest with what Weyerhaeuser has done. And I can respond to the current situation. Do you see what I'm getting at? And so I think what we need to do is we need to respond to our current circumstances. That's really, we need to act responsibly in terms of responding to present circumstances, and also in terms of giving in return to the earth for the earth giving us life. So I think that we need to act. Once again, I don't really care why we act. We can act out of terror for all I care, and frankly, I'm pretty terrified. But I think responsibility is a really important thing for us to begin to learn. Okay, now having said that, what's the relationship between that and Christianity and science? I missed that part entirely.
Well, I'm not entirely sure how to rephrase it to make it more clear, but I'm pretty satisfied with your answer so far.
Okay. Okay. I'll talk one more real fast. Is it fast? Okay. This is the last one, real fast.
The neocons pushing their agenda of education, how can future teachers maintain their passion?
With the neocons pushing their agenda
on
education and everything else, how can teachers maintain their passion?
Future
teachers. You know, I think that there is nothing that is better for gaining and maintaining one's passion than some victories. And I think another thing that's very helpful is solidarity. And so I have been, you know, I'm kind of suspicious with some of the stuff that's going on in Egypt and Tunisia and Libya. I don't, you know, the United States has been way too accepting of that. It's making me really nervous. And they're clearly not anti-capitalist revolutions. That said, they're still, it still makes me happy to see people rising up. And I have to admit, I got pretty stoked when I saw those pictures of the Egyptian anti-Mubarak people throwing all the rocks at the promo, and when the tanks were retreating. It's pretty fucking cool. And likewise, I am delighted that people are taking action in Wisconsin. And this goes back to the person's question back there. I think one of the ways you maintain the passion is by having a supportive community. And even if the administration, and I don't just mean the presidential, I mean the school administration, I'm not talking about this school, I don't know anything about this school, but if a school administration is totally fucking you over, then I think it really helps to be able to work with others against that, because we can't do any of this by ourselves. And I'm going to bring this back to art to conclude the whole evening, that I think something else that can help teachers to maintain their passion, there are two parts. One is that they can be supported by artists by having an art of resistance that is helpful to teachers themselves. My hope is that walking on water helps to do that for some teachers. And so there can be that support. And then the other part that I think is even better is even within an oppressive system, you know, sometimes there is always resistance to oppression. And even when the oppression goes underground, it's still there. And so you get people, you get enslaved peoples walking by other enslaved peoples in the 1830s and 40s singing songs about trains. And guess what they're really singing about, you know? And that can seem like a small act, but those are some of the acts that kept those people alive. And so, and the best thing of all is, as a teacher, you have a wonderful opportunity to, and I'm saying this from the perspective of the neocons, you have a wonderful opportunity to corrupt the minds of youth. And that can be enough right there, I think, to maintain the passion, to know, I helped this student, no, I helped this young human being to stay free. You know, I'll tell you, I wrote to my eighth grade teacher, you know, obviously much of my childhood was very unhappy. I wrote probably 4 or 5 years ago, I wrote to my eighth grade teacher, my eighth grade English teacher, and told her I made it. I became a writer. And at that point I had, you know, 10 books out. And she wrote back and said that my note made her career. And you know, I still remember my track coach in college. There are some teachers, it is not too much to say that there are some teachers who saved my life. And you know, no matter what form they put you in, you can still reach the students. You know, fuck the administrators and fuck the neocons. You're there for the students. Which seems like a good note to end on. Oh, just in, for people looking for a community, a new site was just launched to bring Portland area collaborations and conversations together. PortlandSkillshare.com. PortlandSkillshare.com. Okay, so thank you very much. This is a remix.
V tokratni temnozeleni smo poslušali tretji zaključni del posnetka predavanja Civilization and Resistance ameriškega pisatelja, filozofa in okoljskega aktivista Derika Jensena. Ostane nam le še, da vas povabimo na ogled odličnega ameriškega dokumentarca The Freedom Riders na večeru, ki ga akcijska skupina Deep Green Resistance Slovenija pripravlja v sodelovanju z A Infoshopom na Metelkovi. Vabljene in vabljeni v A Infoshop v petek 24. avgusta ob 19. uri. Ogledu filma sledi diskusija, upamo, da vroča in navdihujoča. Družili smo se v 7. ediciji temnozelene brezskrupulozno naravocentrične radijske oddaje. Z vami sem bila Katarina. Ponovno smo na zvezi v soboto 25. avgusta. Ostanite dobro in nadaljujte s pripravami na vročo jesen. Čau.
Temnozelena. O mraku na zemlji in tistih, ki mi žijo. Osvobajamo naravo v senci. Osvobajamo okolje senc. Najsvetlejša oddaja o za naravo najtemnejših časih. Najbolj aktivistična med 16.777.216 barvami. Oddaja, ki ne farba. Ko se med 490 in 570 nanometri steni na 89,3.